Welcome to this 11KBW podcast, The Dolls Bill Before Parliament by Hannah Slarks. This talk was given at the 11KBW Community Care, COP and Health Conference on the 14th of May 2019 at the Crown Plaza on New Bridge Street in London. For more information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Most days I wake up in the morning and I thank God that I am not Theresa May. I might have a stinking cold, and I might have to speak in a pre-coffee break talk to you lot in a room that I think is frankly still too warm. But at least I don't feel like this. In fact, however exasperated I feel with our current elected representatives and their total inability to sort anything out, I think we can all agree that their jobs aren't easy. Day after day after day after day, they have to try and solve Brexit. And for their light relief, they get the mental capacity bill. And if they thought that this was going to be their light relief, they were sadly mistaken. And that's what we're here to talk about today. So today we will run through a brief overview of how we got to where we are. We will look at the new definition of deprivation of liberty. Spoiler alert, there is no new definition of deprivation of liberty. We will look at the new liberty protection safeguards, which are new but may or may not solve the problem. And then we will be asking, is there anything that we as lawyers can do beyond retreating under a duvet with a box set of Fleabag? Also a valid response. So, how did we get here? As we all know, the problem started with the Baroness and her decision in Cheshire West. Her explanation of the acid test for deprivation of liberty exponentially broadened the definition. Now, the test is very familiar to us all. I haven't put it up on the slide, but we all know it. Is P subject to continuous supervision and control, and is P free to leave? And the sudden broadening of the definition meant that huge numbers of people were brought within the scope of the Mental Capacity Act Deprivation of Liberty safeguards, DOLS. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the figures, before Cheshire West and the year before Cheshire West, there were 13,000 DOLS applications that year. Last year, there were 230,000 applications. The Law Commission estimated that if this was funded properly, massive if, it would cost £2.2 billion a year. That is, I think, something like 2% of the overall NHS budget that would have to go just on DOLS. So obviously the government didn't fund it, and they didn't even fund it when we JR'd them and told them to fund it. And as a result, over half of DOLS cases have been stuck in a backlog. Local authorities' teams have been pretty well on their knees, while tens and cumulatively hundreds of thousands of people have been deprived of their liberty without any of the legal safeguards intended by the existing statutory regime. So the courts tried their best to improve things. They tried to clarify and, where appropriate, narrow the acid test. And certain judges, big shout out for Mostyn here, went on a crusade to undo and ignore it as best they could. In his capacity as the president of the Court of Protection, Mumby tried and pretty well failed to introduce a lawful and functional fast-track DOLS procedure. But it was always clear that Parliament was going to have to sort this out. And this was an urgent and pressing problem. So what was the government going to do? It was going to kick it off to the Law Commission. And in the blink of an eye, a mere 3 years later, in 2017, the Law Commission produced a draft bill for Parliament to consider. Now, my feeling is this. If we have learned anything about this particular Parliament, it's that when faced with a really difficult problem, they 100% are not going to solve it. And guess what? They did not solve it. So they had two things they could do to fix the Cheshire West problem. And they probably had to succeed at both in order to actually solve the problem. A, they could narrow the definition of deprivation of liberty, or B, and or B, they could create a more streamlined system of safeguards for those people who are deprived of their liberty. And let's be fair to them, neither of these jobs was easy. Why was this so difficult? Because the court had already made a total hash of both of these questions, and they had made a convention-based hash, so it wasn't readily easy to unpick. Parliament couldn't unhash it. So that brings us to the rehash that is the deprivation of, that is the mental capacity bill, passed by Parliament only a few weeks ago. Drum roll, please. So first, the new definition. That's right, folks. There is no new definition. And I should say here that a team of my colleagues put an astonishing amount of time and effort into trying to help government and parliament come up with a better definition. And I've talked to them about some of the creative solutions that they proposed. And they were really interesting and clever. And in fact, they were so interesting that I think Jonathan Orban wanted me to spend my entire talk on how great it would have been if anybody had listened to them. Sadly, they did not. The government proposed new definitions, but Parliament couldn't agree on one. There was no one definition of dolls that could command a majority, which of course has a very familiar Brexit-y feel to it. In the last few months of the bill's progress, the attempt to redefine dolls was dropped. One can only hope that the same approach might be taken to the Brexit problem. So now the definition of deprivation of liberty is exactly the same as it was under the old Act, where there wasn't really a definition either. The definition is purely by reference to Article 5. If someone is deprived of their liberty under Article 5, they're deprived of their liberty for the purposes of the Act. And any further clarity will have to come in the form of guidance or litigation, but it's not going to be in primary legislation. We know that now. And on the one hand, I feel like, fair enough, that was a really difficult job. You gave it a good go. It was going to be hard to find a narrower definition of the acid test that didn't breach Article 5. And on the other hand, I want to say to Parliament, come on, redefining dolls was basically the most important thing you had to do if you achieved nothing else. Just have a go at this. And you haven't done it. And maybe that's how Nigel Farage feels about Brexit. I don't know. Does Nigel Farage feel things? I don't know. I'm afraid my view is that without a new definition, the dolls problem isn't fixed and it's not going to go away. The pressure on the system may ease somewhat, and I hope it does, but it won't be resolved. And the lack of clarity surrounding how the acid test would be applied to specific situations is going to have to be gradually and painstakingly addressed by the courts. Now, I've put on this slide some examples of the important definitional questions that still need to be addressed in litigation. Now, of course, everything I say in today's talk is useful, but I will tell you that this is the actually useful bit. You might want to get your pens out for this bit, only this bit. I've given 9 examples of definitional questions that are still to be answered. And the first is, can P give valid consent, which is sometimes known as tacit consent? And this has been, I think, the most interesting and controversial question that we grappled with but failed to answer in the recent debate. The question is it possible for P, who lacks capacity, to somehow give de facto or tacit consent anyway? So basically, if P seems to understand the situation and seems sort of basically happy with the situation, can we ever take that to mean valid consent? There's some Strasbourg authority supporting this idea, particularly a case called Mihailovs and Latvia, and another case called M and Ukraine. Now, interestingly, a lot of disability rights campaigners have advocated for this idea, and they've talked about it as a way of helping to empower P and respect that P has preferences and take those preferences seriously. I have to say that I find the idea very problematic. I find it hard to see how we can say, on the one hand, that P doesn't have enough capacity to give proper consent, but on the other hand, does understand the situation well enough to give tacit consent. And I'm not comfortable that it is empowering to P for us to assume that she is agreeing to being deprived of her liberty when we've just decided that she has no capacity to do so, especially when the effect of that is to remove all the safeguards that the Act would otherwise provide. But it remains an open question. It hasn't been decided either way. Next, does supervision require a direct line of sight? So if a person is subject to continuous and complete supervision, if there are care home staff in the building, but the resident is allowed to spend all day in their room and nobody is watching them there, nobody can see them there, are they subject to continuous supervision? We haven't had a judgment on that. Does supervision have to be truly continuous? So on a strict reading of the word continuous, if a person is locked in, cannot leave, but there are parts of the day where they have free time, so perhaps they go out into a walled garden, they are unsupervised, they are walking around doing their own thing, does that mean that the supervision wasn't continuous? It doesn't seem right, and indeed it doesn't sit very well with Strasbourg decision called Stanov and Bulgaria, but we don't know. What is the relevance of someone living in their own home? In principle, there is no reason why the acid test can't apply to people in their own homes. But no Strasbourg case has ever found there to be a deprivation of liberty in P's own home. And it seems to me worth the courts considering whether it's the case that a more restrictive package is required before the court will reach a conclusion that deprivation of liberty in one's home has happened. And if a more restrictive package is required, what would that package look like? Is it right that the thing preventing the person from leaving must be imputable to the state? So this is a natural consequence of the reasoning in the cases of Ferreira and also the Alfie Evans case, which say that the reason why P cannot leave, if the reason why is their underlying illness, then they're not dolled. So if the reason why they're not leaving is because they're in a coma, they're not dolled. We can be fairly sure that that is now the law because the Supreme Court refused permission in both Ferreira and Alfie Evans, and did so on quite a general basis. But it's such an important point that I think most of us would be more comfortable if there was Supreme Court authority on the point. When can a dole by a private individual be imputable to the state? So we know that responsibility can be imputed to the state where the state owes the individual in question a positive obligation. And that happens when the state knows or ought to have known that an individual is subject to confinement by a private individual. But following the Staffordshire litigation, there's still significant uncertainty about whose knowledge is sufficient and in what circumstances a public authority ought to have known about a state of affairs. Next, what about people who are free to leave permanently but not on a day-to-day basis? So an example might be a voluntary patient. As long as they're there, they can't just come and go as they please, but they could, in theory, choose to move their placement elsewhere. Now, that would seem to fall outside an ordinary reading of the acid test, but there is no authority on it. What does the control element add? If someone is not free to leave and they're continuously supervised, wouldn't that be enough to establish control? What would control add in that situation, and what case would you find that those two elements weren't enough? And finally, are not free to leave and under continuous supervision and control really both separate requirements? Now, the Baroness said pretty clearly that they were in Cheshire West, and there's authority on that since, so it looks clear. And I accept that it will be quite a rare case that someone is free to do whatever they want as long as they don't try to leave. They're effectively locked up and then ignored, cared for. But intuitively, it seems to me that some situations like that would feel like a dole, and that's not something that the courts have grappled with. Yeah, so when you look at all those questions, you think it might be useful if Parliament had answered any of them. But here we are. So let's look at what Parliament did achieve, the new Dolls system, the Liberty Protection Safeguards. I'll take you through through five basic elements of the new regime. First, the Act introduced a new interim authorisation. So this won't clear the backlog, but it will give legal status to those cases who are in the queue. Pending authorisation from the COP, pending an authorisation under the new Schedule AA1, the new LPS system, or in an emergency, an interim authorisation can be granted, so those cases have legal status. Secondly, the Act shares out the DOLS load. If PE is DOLed mainly in an NHS hospital, the responsible body will be a hospital manager. If they are DOLed under continuing healthcare, but mainly not in an NHS hospital, then the CCG, or local health board, will be responsible. And in all other cases, it will be the local authority. Crucially, the local authority will have the ability to take a decision to delegate their job to a care home manager. And that is quite a key plank of the reforms contained in the legislation. Next, the responsible body will commission or undertake three assessments to see whether the three conditions for a DOL are met: capacity, mental disorder, necessary and proportionate. Before authorisation is granted, these assessments must be reviewed by a person who is not involved in the treatment or day-to-day care of the person, of P. And they must consider whether it is reasonable for the responsible body to conclude the conditions are met. And if P objects, or if they are in a private hospital, I'll come back to that exception, an approved mental capacity professional, an AMCP, as they are catchily known, must carry out the review. Finally, we've got three forms of safeguard after the DOL is granted. We've got a right to information about the process and the decision-making, a right to apply to the Court of Protection, and regular reviews. The authorisation record must include a programme of regular reviews, and there are a variety of other statutory triggers, including a reasonable request. So that's the simple overview. Now on to the important questions. What have they done to help ease the pressure? One, delegation to care homes is unquestionably a key way of removing the workload from local authorities. I will come back to the problems with it. Two, it will now be permitted to reuse capacity and mental disorder assessments where appropriate. So that avoids duplicating what might, in some cases, be an unnecessary assessment. Again, there's obvious problems with it. Third, the role of IMCAs has been reduced down, and it's worth explaining this in a little more detail. Appropriate persons in the new statutory regime who somewhat take over from RPRs will no longer have access to an IMCA. If P has capacity to request an IMCA, they may get one if they ask. I was about to say they will, but even that takes it too far. If P lacks capacity to request an IMCA, there's a new best interest test as to whether they get one. Query when it will not be in their best interest to have one, but there is this test. Even then, there is no unqualified duty to appoint an IMCA. The duty is to take all reasonable steps to appoint an IMCA if these criteria are satisfied. Query whether not having the resources or not having enough access to IMCAs is going to mean that it's reasonable not to appoint one. Again, that's a question that needs to be answered. So all of this will substantially reduce the burden associated with IMCAs. And of course, IMCAs are expensive and there weren't enough of them available. And that was a key contributor to the backlog. So you can see why they were trying to reduce the role of IMCAs. As I say, we'll come on to the problems. Fourth, longer renewal periods. So now we can have a 3-year renewal period instead of a 1-year renewal period, which should lighten the load of reviews. Fifth, When a person moves settings or key aspects of their deprivation of liberty circumstance change, you now don't have to go back to the beginning with the assessment. You can vary the DOL. So you've got a variation process rather than a new process. And finally, interim authority. Although it doesn't cut the backlog, it gives some kind of legitimacy to the backlog in a way that at least gives legal status to the people involved. Concerns about this. The downside of streamlining the system is, of course, reduced safeguards for vulnerable people. Most of my biggest concerns here surround the role of care managers. The delegated role of arranging a compliant assessment is a tricky job. And I have doubts, with great respect, as to whether all care managers charged with it will be qualified to do it. And that is partly because the government's impact assessment suggests that only half a day of training will be sufficient to prepare care managers for this new role. That does not ring true. There's also, I think, a potential conflict of interest here. And Parliament, strangely, they spotted this issue when they were thinking about private hospitals. They realised that private hospitals have a financial incentive to approve a DOL. So they said that whenever a DOL assessment was taking place in a private hospital, the pre-authorisation review had to be conducted by an AMCP. But there's no equivalent requirement in a care home, and I just don't see the logic. There's exactly the same financial incentive there, but there's the safeguard in one area and not the other. It doesn't make sense to me. There are also logistical issues. Do care managers actually have time to do this? And do they have sufficient knowledge and experience of P before P becomes a resident with them? Or is it more likely, just as it is now, P will become a resident, the deprivation of liberty will begin, and only really at that point, when the care manager has access, will the system start to kick in? As to my other concerns, the flip side of the reduced role of IMCAs, the restricted role of AMCPs, and the introduction of the three-year renewal period, they're all obvious. This is a zero-sum game between easing the burden on the system on the one hand and ensuring adequate safeguards for those subject to it on the other hand. So what can we do? If you feel that screaming into your pillow is the only appropriate response, we will be handing out 11KBW branded pillows at the end of the talk. But here are some other ideas. First, we need to wait. The revised code of practice may well be bolder than the primary legislation was at trying to find ways to answer definitional questions and narrow Cheshire West. I say that, I should stress, with no insider information and only hope. And let's face it, hope at this stage is misguided. We will have statutory instruments, and they will fill in some of the details, such as the qualifications necessary for AMCPs. And then the bill itself is expected to become law in spring of 2020. Secondly, and the more popular option for most of us in this room, litigate. Given the current state of the law, it's very easy to look at most DOL's cases and say, yeah, that person's probably deprived of their liberty. Let's move on to the process bit. And indeed, that is the starting assumption of most of the cases that cross our desks. And that's one of the reasons why so many definitional questions are left unanswered, because in many cases, people just don't ask this question. So I suggest this, if I do say so myself, print out my slide about definitional questions. Cross out the ones you don't agree with, add some of your own. Stick it above your desk. Every time you have a DOL's case, ask yourself, am I confident that this person is being deprived of their liberty? Or is this a case that raises one of these important definitional questions that really need to be ventilated in the court? And finally, of course, we expect litigation on the extent to which the new LPS system is going to be compliant with Article 5. So there we are. We have a new bill. The definition of deprivation of liberty remains a problem. The new slimmed down safeguards may help ease the pressure somewhat, but at what price? And once again, the focus is likely to return to litigation to take things forward. Thank you.